Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust way back in 2002. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com. This week, Professor Tom Mills from Aston University in Birmingham's got a book out, and you won't be hearing maybe about it on the BBC. It's called The BBC, The Myth of a Public Service. We'll be speaking to him about the election and what power the BBC has to swing the vote. Also, Sangeeta Kansal's with us, talking about property fraud in India from her own bitter experience. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. And if you want to join in, I'll give the details at the end of the show. But we start this week by looking at something called the Bilderberg Conference. Now, this is a meeting of elites that happens every year. When I say elites, what I mean is mostly bankers, people from the oil industry. I've been talking about Goldman Sachs as bankers, Shell Oil, all the big people, also media. So that is to say some of the big national newspapers, things like News International, his general manager of Rupert Murdoch goes to these meetings. And essentially they are a place where the West's elite meet together. Now, Will Hutton, the former editor of The Observer, described the Bilderberg as where the forming the consensus against which the backdrop of policy was made worldwide. Very powerful meetings set up in 1954 originally by Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, who was a former SS officer, who then he married into, just before the war, into the Dutch royal family. And he was one of the people who was responsible, many believe, for the disaster of the Battle of Arnhem in a film, A Bridge Too Far. But anyway, he was the chairman for the first 20 years when there was something called the Lockheed scandal, and he had to resign. And the meeting is one of the most powerful in the Western world, very, very closely connected with NATO. And strange how people like Bill Clinton, Tony Blair, turn up at a Bilderberg meeting, and then suddenly the next year they become either leader of the opposition or they get nominated to be president and then become president. So they are kingmakers, effectively. This year's meeting, there's no official announcement. Various investigative journalists and researchers and geeks around the world do their best to try and find out where these meetings are going to take place. And this meeting in 2017, they're usually around the end of May, beginning of June, there's been no leaks whatsoever, apart from a bit of estimation by some of us here in the UK looking at hotels. And it looks like the Westfield Marriott Hotel in Chantilly, Virginia, is going to be where they're meeting at the beginning of June. That is the 1st to the 4th of June at Westfield's Marriott, Chantilly, Virginia, but nobody's sure. And for the first time, US police and security services haven't confirmed or denied whether this is the actual meeting, even though that hotel has been block booked for that session. They won't tell anybody who's meeting. So it's just guesswork, effectively. Now, this is an important thing for journalists to look at and know about. But of course, if there is no pre-warning that the meeting's going to be there, it's impossible for it to be covered by anything but the immediate, like Washington media, who happen to be nearby. It involves booking flights, hotels, all that sort of thing. And by which time, if you've done that, potentially anyway, the story's disappeared and everyone's flown home again. So, there's a definite attempt to make this very difficult for the public to follow and for the press to follow and for politicians to follow, for many people. The reason it's so significant is this new French president, Emmanuel Macron, he is very, very close to the Bilderberg conference. In fact, he went, funnily enough, to the Bilderberg meeting in 2014 in Copenhagen. And everyone was saying, well, who is this guy? We've never seen him before. Suddenly, now in 2017, 3 years later, he's president of France. Come out of nowhere, they say, but no. That actually really means coming out of Bilderberg and the forces that it represents, the NATO forces, the banking forces, the military forces, the various economic forces. So there is also a big thing this year is that the patron of Bilderberg, who's been going for many years, David Rockefeller, from the oil dynasty family in the US, still very, very powerful, one of the richest in the world, but they're very good at hiding their wealth. He died recently at the age of 101. And the bankers and the oil men that used to run Bilderberg in the old days now have passed their curse on to the likes of Peter Thiel and Eric Schmidt. If you've not heard of those, Peter Thiel was the founder of Facebook, the founder of PayPal, right now runs things, so it's like something called Palantir Technologies, which do data mining for governments. Eric Schmidt, of course, is the Google boss. But these are the sort of people who are now running Bilderberg. And they are very, very influential when it comes to the algorithms, when it comes to elections, this kind of thing. It's a kind of technocracy that they're now running. Also, I wonder if Bilderberg will be discussing the Nazi false flag terror cells, which are being uncovered in the German army after a German soldier was caught planting a gun with his fingerprints on, and he'd also registered as a Syrian refugee at Vienna Airport. The German police believe he was planning to kill people at Vienna Airport, conduct a terror attack, and leave his fingerprints on so the attack would be blamed on the refugees. So this sort of thing, I wonder if the Bilderberg will be discussing that. I imagine that they will be looking at the appointment of their president to France rather than Marine Le Pen as a victory in order to try and keep together the EU, which is very much part of what they want to do, a kind of United States of Europe rather modelled on the United States of America. So they'll also, I would imagine, be looking at forwarding the EU army, which is going on apace. I just passed a French or a Belgian army patrol on the M5 the other day. I was quite surprised to see them here. What are they up to? Is that still EU army still going ahead? And all the fallout from Brexit, they'll be doing everything they can to make sure that Britain does everything to stay in under control of things like the European Central Bank, the European Parliament, and the Eurocrats. So the other thing that might be being discussed there is the proposed merger of the German Börse stock exchange with the UK stock exchange, which it now looks as if that won't happen. But anyway, all these things being discussed by some of the most powerful, certainly the richest people in the entire Western world, at the Westfields Marriott Chantilly, Virginia, from the 1st to the 4th of June, or maybe not, because they don't want us to know anything about it. And that's one of the reasons there hasn't been hardly any news stories about it, is because they're keeping it very, very secret, but not on dialect.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
My name's Tom Mills. I'm a sociologist at Aston University. The book's called The BBC, Myth of a Public Service. It's based on my PhD research that I completed a couple of years before the book was published.
Now, at the moment, we're going through a very important phase for the BBC, that is in pre-election time. I wonder what you make of the way that the various different parties are being covered. And I think, you know, there's always a understanding that some parties, minor parties that don't get many votes, are not going to get as much coverage as the ruling party. But anyway, what's your take on the sort of coverage the BBC has been delivering during this general election campaign so far?
Yeah, I've been a little surprised, really. I mean, the BBC has usually been very careful, at least in its sort of the volume of coverage it gives to different parties. It tries to reflect, broadly speaking, the influence of those parties, and the tone usually is very professional and measured. I've been quite surprised by some of the tone of the coverage. It seems to me, although of course it's very subjective, to be broadly quite supportive of the Conservatives, or at least quite harsh on Labour. We'll see what happens as more formal studies start to emerge. There's one being conducted in Cardiff. There's another study being conducted by the Media Reform Coalition. So all I can offer is some sort of impressions, which perhaps may be better informed in terms of my understanding of the politics of the BBC, but, you know, as subjective as anyone else is.
Isn't the BBC always bound to give better coverage to the government of the day, because effectively they're responsible for appointing the top people at the BBC? So we're bound to get some spin from the BBC supporting the government of the day, surely?
Yeah, well, that's true to an extent, certainly. I think the BBC will tend to reflect the perspectives of the politically dominant party, let's say. So, you know, you can imagine a scenario where the government's very weak and it wouldn't be portrayed favourably. And I think arguably that happened in the Meiji period as the government started to collapse and became much more politically weak. And to some extent, the BBC reflected that. And you can see some of the same patterns of reporting that occurred around the time the Brown government started to go into kind of a political decline. So I think the BBC, yeah, will broadly be pro-government in electoral periods. They tend to be very measured, but will broadly reflect the kind of policy consensus within the political elite and within the newspapers. So a lot of that ends up reflecting in the BBC's coverage. So that's not just about being pro-government, it's a basic orientation towards the interests and perspectives of powerful groups, which is, I think, the best way to see it. Usually, the sorts of patterns, insofar as they reflect the bias, tend to be quite subtle. So we saw in the last election, for example, the BBC's reporting tended to highlight issues on which the Conservatives are very strong and tended to downplay somewhat issues on which Labour was strong. So, for example, on the NHS or housing, these were kind of downgraded in the coverage, and discussions of potential formation of coalitions, discussions of the economy, the issues on which the Conservatives polled well tend to feature much more prominently in BBC's reporting. So that was the last election. And in this election, my own feeling is that the bias, if you want to call it that, has been somewhat more overt. I mean, we've seen some quite remarkable tweets coming out of some leading sort of political figures within the BBC, which, you know, I can't see that they would be seen as politically appropriate.
Can you give us some examples, Tom, of the sorts of tweets you're talking about?
Yeah, I mean, there was Emily Maitlis, who didn't get as criticised as Nick Robinson or Koonsberg, who's being constantly criticised. I mean, I think rightly in some cases for her tweets, but Emily, I think Maitlis, I hope if I'm pronouncing that certainly right, but she sort of speculated within a couple of hours of Theresa May calling the general election whether there was time for a coup against Jeremy Corbyn, you know, sort of musing about it on Twitter. Nick Robinson was criticised for saying that Corbyn is very low on, sorry, I can't remember the exact phrase he used, but he said something like, not a lot of detail on policy, but that's the story of Jeremy Corbyn's life. Early on in the after the campaign was announced.
So that's interesting, isn't it? Because these are starting to get very personal, like a personal attack. This is an attack on Jeremy Corbyn's life rather than on his policy or his delivery or whatever. But I mean, you're talking about, and you've said just there, you know, some of this is your feelings, is subjective. Is there any kind of within the whole world of journalism studies and media studies, any kind of real objective way of looking at the press, not just the BBC, obviously the BBC particularly, but to see if, you know, is there a measure that you can make of whether they're being fair or not?
Yeah, of course. I mean, you know, These things are usually relatively straightforward to measure. I mean, is that way which you go about it or code different perspectives or opinions, you know, can vary. So, but, you know, you can go about it in a scientific fashion in the sense that, you know, you can have an explicit methodology and you can try and do it rigorously in a way which, you know, would get similar results if the experiment were repeated. So you can do these things scientifically and, you know, my impressions of the current election, as I say, are impressions. But I mean, going back to what I was saying about the 2015 election, you know, that was a scholarly study which looked at the ways in which different issues receive more prominence within television news. And there's actually quite extensive body of work, really, about the BBC and its reporting. And the findings are pretty consistent. I mean, I was at a research seminar the other day for media and communication scholars, and there were a number of papers presented, and they all found broadly the same patterns of reporting on the BBC, which was that official sources tend to predominate, Westminster sources and economic elites. And this has been a pretty consistent finding of media scholarship since the 1970s. So there's not really, I mean, there can be different patterns of reportage, you know, things change over time, different parts of the BBC report in different fashion, but the overall picture is pretty consistent and it's as close to a consensus as you get in social science, I think.
Now, you're talking there about the economic elite, which I mean, we've had on this programme, we've had people like Ian Fraser, Steve Keen, who are economists who are very much against the kind of mainstream. And Ian Fraser pointed out that many of the city journalists, economics journalists, are very, very close to the sorts of institutions that they're actually reporting on, you know, the big city institutions, big investment banks, hedge funds, hedge fund managers, and this kind of thing. So there is this kind of economic consensus, supposed consensus, which really does pervade not only the City of London and the big financial institutions, but also includes, as part of those institutions, many of the main economics editors of Fleet Street or the London media nowadays, Steve Keen has put it very simply. He says there needs to be a Copernican revolution in economics, because it's almost as if the whole of the economics discipline sees the Earth going around the sun, and they need to take a step back, and actually it's the sun going around the Earth. So what he's also talking about is that the funding for a lot of economics departments at university, a lot of that seems to be quite controlled as well. So I'd just like to mention somebody we're going to have a little clip from after we've spoken to you, Tom, a guy called Michael Hudson, who's another economist who really pulls apart this artificial consensus on the economy, because this is one of the main ways, I think, in which people end up voting for a party that's actually not going to benefit them economically, and maybe they're going to be impoverished as a result of voting. There's a lot of bamboozling goes on in these elections. Anyway, look, just to come back to your book, Tom, what made you, in a way, pick on the BBC? Because you're saying the title of the book is The Myth of Public Service Broadcasting, isn't it? So you're definitely targeting the BBC. Why are you doing that?
The reason I was interested in the BBC was partly to do with the sort of puzzle around the Iraq war. I mean, I ended up in my PhD focusing on economics reporting, which I can talk about more following some of your comments there. But my original interest was in war, and it's war reporting, on which there's also a lot of literature. What interests me about the BBC was that there were studies which showed that the BBC had been broadly pro-government in terms of how it portrayed the case for the Iraq war. And then, of course, it famously reports that the government believes that there aren't weapons of mass destruction, that the case has been sexed up and the rest of it. And this leads to a very bitter conflict between the BBC and the government. I wanted to try and understand what's going on with this institution. We seem to have something of a puzzle here, where on the one hand, it was broadly reflecting the interests of government. On the other hand, it was reflecting critical perspectives to the extent that the government was willing to attack it. And so there was something interesting going on there. I wanted to make sense of that, but also I wanted to get a sense of the institution, the nuts and bolts of how it works. What was it that led the BBC to report in a certain way, to be more, let's say, deferential towards powerful interests, to be more pro-war, to be more favourable to economic elites, as we were discussing. Now, what happened was when I started my PhD research, I more or less registered for my PhD at the time that Lehman Brothers was collapsing. And I thought, well, actually, it'd be very interesting, rather than me focusing on war, to examine a different issue, which was how is the BBC reflecting this economic consensus, which seemed to me sometimes, in some ways, to be more described. I mean, patterns of ownership, influence, and the influence of funding and these sorts of things aren't present at the BBC. There's no obvious reason why a publicly funded broadcast like the BBC should be reflecting these particular set of economic interests. So that's what I was interested in examining. That's why I spent quite a lot of time researching, and that's what eventually led to the book. Now, what happened to see, and I spent quite a lot of time in the book describing this process, was that as what we now call neoliberalism, that this particular set of economic ideas about the role of competition and free markets and so on, sort of agenda associated with Thatcherism, as that started to transform British society, the BBC too went through a very radical process of transformation from the 1980s and then into the noughties, if you like, under Greg Dyke. And there were two elements of that. I mean, one element was that it became much more integrated into the market. It started taking content from the private sector. Its whole operations took on a more business-like fashion. Business values were instituted throughout the BBC in the way that it was structured and the way that it related to other media producers. And the second element was its reporting. I mean, in the 1970s and 80s, the BBC still had labour reporters who would talk about the economy in a different way. They would describe it as being related to a set of interests. They would see the jobs of companies as being to provide jobs and wages for people. And this was instituted in a certain pattern of reporting. Now, all of that changed under the leadership of a guy called John Burt, who was Director General of the BBC. He joined the BBC in 1987 after Alastair Milne, who was the Director General at that time, was sort of forced out by a Thatcher-appointed chairman. And Burt comes in and he shifts the BBC. He's very unpopular, but he pushes the BBC in this direction. And the sort of long and short of it is that the BBC became a much more business-orientated institution. So that by the time the crisis hits in 2008, we're almost 10 years down the line now, there was a certain way of understanding it. What you described in terms of these sort of economistic ways of understanding the world were very deeply entrenched in the BBC's structure and its reporting practices.
Well, up until recently, the chair of the BBC Trust, which is now dissolved, but for the last few years has been this woman called Rona Fairhead. Now, she's straight from the bank HSBC. HSBC, of course, is implicated in massive money laundering. Well, not implicated, it's been fined hundreds of millions of dollars for money laundering in the United States. And, of course, the obvious question there is, are the BBC, under Rona Fairhead, going to be making an investigative documentary about the criminality and the fraud and the money laundering that was going on within HSBC Bank? Clearly the answer is very unlikely with someone like her at the chair. So what is it? And I mean, previous to her, we had Chris Patten, who was the chairman of the Conservative Party previously. It does look as if that there is a definite political bias going on right from the very top. I wonder, how is it that somebody so implicated in massive criminality as Rona Fairhead was at HSBC on the risk committee, which one imagine would have looked at the risks of, if we launder this money, what's likely to be the consequences, running the Public Service Broadcasting Corporation?
The simple answer is that the banks run British society more or less. They're the sort of elite of the elite, if you like. HSBC is a very powerful bank, along with the other high street banks and, of course, the investment banks as well. So there's the party political aspect of it. I mean, these have always been political appointments, the chairs. It's still going to be the case that the government has political appointees on what's going to be called, what is called the Unified Board. I won't bore listeners with the governance structure, but there's been a slight change. But generally, politicians have appointed people who are the sort of great and the good, as the sort of journalistic cliche has it, of British society, who then run the BBC and oversee its policy. So Rona Fairhead as you say, you know, she was HSBC, one of the most powerful banks. And then, of course, we had Chris Patten. I mean, he was up against somebody who was previously head of the CBI. And then before that, we had Gavin Davis for a period as well. He was chair when Greg Dyke was director general. And Gavin Davis was very close advisor to Gordon Brown and Tony Blair. And he was also an investment banker at Goldman Sachs. So we've had, throughout the BBC's history, you've had people in the top of British society, the elite of the elites, as I just put it, heading the board. And of course, that's the kind of editorial culture at the top. When they appoint the director general who heads BBC's journalism and the whole corporation. And that's one facet of the BBC's kind of official orientation towards politics and the state. And of course, as British society has shifted, as British elites have changed, so the banks became much more powerful from the mid-1990s, so the people at the top of the BBC have reflected those kinds of shifts. So when the Conservatives are running things, these are the kinds of people who they appointed. So the BBC will change as British society changes and as the British elite changes, but these people at the top, that obviously sets a certain sort of organisational tone, if you like, which, as you say, will naturally impact on the broader culture. Not in complex ways. I mean, the BBC is a very big institution. There's very different cultures around different programmes. It's difficult for people at the very top to directly influence what's going on at the bottom. But, you know, these are the people who set the overall strategic aims of the corporation. And they define its culture and they can push through certain changes, as we saw, particularly in the Burton Dyke period. And, you know, arguably under Thompson as well, who succeeded Dyke, who I think pushed the BBC in a much more right-wing populist sort of direction. You know, this was the time when the BNP was on Question Time and UKIP started being a regular fixture on the BBC.
You were talking earlier about the problems back in the 1980s, but if we're coming a little bit closer to now, you're painting a picture of the corporation a little bit maybe like George Orwell, who left the BBC World Service back in the Second World War, saying that the propaganda wasn't working and he thought that actually it would be better for the corporation as a whole if he stopped doing it and he left the BBC. That it's almost like becoming like a ministry of truth. Do you think there's any truth to that? And also, if there is, do you think we should just simply stop watching the BBC, stop paying our licence fee, that kind of thing?
I think, you know, in terms of being a Ministry of Truth, BBC is not being directed by government on most things. Well, how this kind of works is that there are senior, you know, there's regular contact between the BBC and the government, and they, in negotiation with the government, they do set in certain areas the particular sort of editorial approaches and that sort of thing. So we saw that around the coalition government's original austerity agenda, as it's called. So the BBC, it's not that the BBC is simply an instrument of government propaganda, but that said, what it does do is reflect overwhelmingly the interests of the powerful in British society. And I think what we've seen in terms of a change in the BBC is that as elites has become more and more removed from British society at large, the BBC has found itself in a difficult position because it's a public service broadcaster, which is notionally orientated towards the public. But actually, in terms of its institutional structure and its embeddedness within the state and the broader British establishment, a much more important constituency for the BBC is not the public, but, you know, the elites. Now, as the elites and the public start to move away from each other, as we've seen, particularly in the sort of post-crisis period, but it's really been a slow-burning sort of political crisis, if you like, since the 1980s, it's been much more difficult for the BBC to look like a convincing public service broadcaster. Does that mean that we shouldn't listen to or watch the BBC? I mean, I don't think so. I think it's very important that we're aware of the sort of political interests which the BBC will tend to represent. And I think it's important that we're aware of that. I think we should try and be diverse in the different kinds of media that we consume. But I think more importantly, we shouldn't abandon the BBC, not because it's going to offer us necessarily a valuable window on the world, because I think a lot of its reporting is seriously compromised. And we're talking mainly about reporting here rather than the sort of drama and documentaries and these sort of more artistic products that it produces. Not because we're going to get an honest view on the world, but because, you know, notionally, we own the BBC, and I think it's a public organisation that actually belongs to us, the licensed fee payers, which we should stake a claim on. So I think whether you watch BBC News is, you know, I think an individual decision. I think you should certainly be aware of the sort of politics it represents. I'm always very reluctant to tell people to just simply give up on the BBC, not because I think the BBC is wonderful, but because I think it's an important remaining part of our British society, which we as the public have a claim on. Even if in practical terms it tends to be dominated by elites, it should be representing the public interest. And I think that's an important value which we shouldn't take for granted.
Okay, Tom, that's fantastic. Thank you. Now, just a couple of things. I don't know if you know, I worked at the corporation for 3 years. So I worked in at the big local radio station for London, Greater London Radio, in the 90s, and also in local radio down this way in Wiltshire and in, where else was it, Radio Solent. I mean, I was a freelancer, and I mean, it's, you know, I've watched things change bit by bit. I've been in contact with Seamus Milne as well about the sacking of his dad, which was quite an interesting little discussion because he didn't realise. And I don't know if you'd seen, have you read this Marmaduke Hussey's biography? I mean, it's pretty obscure. It's an autobiography, I think, actually, isn't it? Because he talks about that episode. It's like half a page or something. And he makes it clear that it was Victor Rothschild that asked him if he could sack the Director General, and that first approached him, which I think is important. I mean, I wrote an article about it a few years ago, which is called When Margaret Thatcher Died, saying Margaret Thatcher and the Man in the Shadows, which is really looking at Victor Rothschild, who's a Labour peer, although he's very, very influential with Thatcher, as being the kind of, at least one of the people moving behind the scenes to sack Alistair Milne. Not only that, also the circumstances of my having my contract taken off me back down in or just not renewed, down in Salisbury were pretty weird, in that I was investigating with a colleague the allegations of child sexual abuse. I mean, this is where Edward Heath was. And the guy who seemed to be the one who should have been acting but wasn't locally was the deputy chairman of the local district, Salisbury District Council Conservative Party. Now, this is back in 1993, so it's a few years ago. But, I mean, it sort of flagged up to me just as I got this kind of summons to the office and told my contract wouldn't be re-renewed that, you know, in the back of my mind was, well, is it anything to do with this investigation we're doing, you know? And also another thing is my wife's, I don't know what, how, she's not sister-in-law, yeah. She, when they were brought up in Hammersmith, and she did quite a lot of temping at the BBC newsroom in the noughties. And Cass, she was, you know, she's basically just working in a TV newsroom. She was saying, she was, I mean, this is another thing, I was rather shocked. It was just constant cabinet office, backwards and forwards to the newsroom all the time, saying, you know, take this line on this, and this is the main story today, and blah, blah, you know, and that she was quite shocked, thinking that there was some sort of independence, that the news bulletins were effectively being micromanaged by the cabinet office.
Yeah.
So there's just a few little tidbits there for you from my own personal experience of seeing the corporation kind of go from bad to worse. I think around about the early 1990s, 92, 93, was when there seemed to be a almost deadly attacks on all of the most important programs, which were, and news centres, which were challenging government. Effectively, you know, and the military as well. And I think from the early 1990s, that's what I've seen, is it slowly but surely was just shut down, really. You know, there's no real criticism allowed anymore. And where there was an attempt to criticise, as happened with me and the child abuse stuff in Salisbury, we were just removed.
Yeah. I mean, the you know, the whole process of change that the BBC goes through from late 1980s to mid 1990s was exactly that. I mean, describe it in the book, it was basically a combination of marketization and a centralization of editorial authority. And if you look at a lot of the autobiographies from that time, you know, they're very explicit about this. And Burr was brought in with being told to sort out BBC journalism. You know, it was very explicit about that. It was said that journalists were out of control. And one of the things he did was he shut down Lion Grove Studio, which, you know, where all the current affairs programs have been made, which were forming, you know, relatively independent hubs of program making where they were sort of law unto themselves. You know, they would refer out controversial stuff, but broadly speaking, people were allowed to get on with doing whatever they want to do. And that was all curtailed during the 1990s, where it was brought under central editorial authority. But you saw, you know, I think local radio is an interesting one, because for the most part, radio outside of the prestigious current affairs programming isn't monitored to the same sort of degree. You know, so you don't, it's not like centralized news. You have this very routine interaction between state sources and news. You do have, I mean, all that stuff comes in, obviously, but you, broadly speaking, people are allowed to get on with stuff. So local radio, I think, does take on a slightly different flavour because of that. But I mean, my impression is that a lot of that stuff, you know, like, tends to be more tabloidy, really. And that's the safest way to go.
I mean, they're definitely trying to do that. The other thing I'd say is regional broadcasting seems to be fairly good too. I mean, we've got, you know, we've got... Yeah, pretty good regional hub here, you know, where the journalists, if they're getting lent on editorially and they don't agree with it, will push back, you know, and they're not worried about losing their jobs, which is obviously terrible from a BBC point of view.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, the BBC since the beginning, you know, actually tried to, I mean, it was one of the things that Reith did in the 1930s was to stamp out the more independent, sort of public-spirited regional broadcasting, you know, in Birmingham and Manchester and places like that. But you've also got, I mean, surprisingly, in Northern Ireland, they seem to have a much more free sort of BBC there within the sort of local political context. You know, I mean, the only BBC stuff I've done for the book has been in Talkback in Northern Ireland. Which was a funny sort of show because everyone wanted to ask me about whether the BBC was biased towards the Republicans or not. But you know, the presenter was more or less like you, sort of asking me what the book was about. You know, not being not necessarily not trying to sort of interrogate me like I'm a politician, which is I'm sure it would happen if I ever got on Radio 4, who said they were going to have me on repeatedly and then never did. So I think regional broadcasting, local radio, the BBC is kept on a longer leash. But, you know, that's because it's not considered to be as politically important. You know, all the spin doctors are focused in on current affairs broadcasting, the Today programme, Newsnight and those sorts of things. And obviously, you know...
I mean, the live show I do here is... I mean, you know, we're finding whenever it comes up towards an election period, the Tories just disappear off the face of the earth. You know, they're interested in making sure that they get their message out through national press. But when it comes to... you know, a little local program like ours, you know, we're quite often left with Labour, Lib Dem, Green, UKIP and no Tory. because they just see it as that's not the environment they want to be in, where any questions can just pop up and they may be embarrassed and it may blow up on them, you know. So they're very, very, very controlling, I think. I mean, more than not so that I've seen. The 2015 general election, we had our hustings here with the Conservatives, were the only party that didn't show up, you know. So, and they will also, between you and me, lie, you know. So they'll come up with some sort of, oh, well, there's a minister in town today and so we can't be with you. And then you find out there was no minister in town, you know. It's just nonsense. So, anyhow.
Yeah, look, well, I guess that's pretty routine for them, isn't it? Just lying about everything.
Yeah, it's the easiest thing to do, isn't it? Anyway, so anyway, nice to chat to you, Tom. Thanks very much.
Super. Thanks.
All right.
Cheers, Tony.
Cheers. All the best.
Bye.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
I'm Miss Anki to Cancel, and I live in South East London, where I've lived all my life and I was born here, and I'm British Asia.
So tell us why you don't think you've had justice. You don't seem to think that the establishment has treated you right.
Yes, correctly. Well, basically, it started off with a property matter to do with our family in India, and I hired lawyers in England who are from India. They're property lawyers called NRI Legal Services, who trade in four different places in England in heavily concentrated Indian areas.
Where are they?
Well, they're originally from India, but they are based in four companies in England, in Harrow, in Birmingham, in Leicester. I'm not sure where the fourth one is, but these three, and I can't remember where the fourth one is.
Okay, and so how did you get on with them?
Well, I hired them because they're advertised literally by all the Indian media in England, by all the radio stations, all the television stations, all the newspapers. They're everywhere, literally. And my uncle was fraudulently and illegally claiming possession of my father's property in India. And his lawyer had written a very unscrupulous letter, you know, just cooking up a story.
Hang on, you've just said that he's illegally got the property. What evidence do you have for that?
Well, his lawyer cooked up a story that my father promised him possession and made a whole history which has got no evidence. My uncle simply had a very limited power of attorney as a caretaker, and this was actually attested and signed in the Indian High Commission in England. So there can be no doubt about what his role was, absolutely no doubt.
So what happened?
Well, I hired these lawyers because there was criminal activity going on in the property, like locks had been broken and people were living there without our permission. All our belongings had been taken and, you know, the story, and it just goes on and on. These lawyers, Mrs. Nidhi Singh from NRI Legal Services, firstly she charged me exorbitant fees, £2,000 for simple searches. Then she hardly gave me any documents. She did not disclose all the criminal activity that was going on. And she actually weakened a perfectly strong case by claiming that my father owed the local authority there about £100,000, which he did not, because I've got the original file. So I smelt a rat, basically. And I became very angry with them. And what I did do was I actually got all their referees, because I had their details, and I told them what was going on. They then became rather alarmed at this, and they tried to bribe me into silence by saying that we will give your money back as long as you remain silent and don't tell anybody. And I said, I will only meet with you and settle something amicably if you give me all my search documents, which is what I hired you to do. And they didn't give me hardly any documents. Now, what were they trying to conceal?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, what motive do you place on what they were doing?
Well, I had heard from many good, reliable sources that they had actually illegally transferred this property and two others, the total probably amount to about £1 million, all illegally into my relatives' names in India. All my relatives who are living in India, they'd actually transferred them into their names. And this is what I had heard. And so I hired a second barrister who practices in England and he practices in India. he actually disclosed in his report that actually that the house was being illegally occupied, the door locks had been changed, the bills had all been transferred into my uncle's names. So why did the original lawyers and NRI Legal Services not disclose
it? Well, don't you think it would have been better to take out some sort of legal action in India rather than over here?
Well, no, because this lawyer actually practices in both countries, so, you know, he's there half the time, and half the time he's in England. In fact, most of the time he's in India, actually, even though he's a British citizen. So it was fine. It was fine, actually, to hire him. But, I smelt a rat. I said, well, look, these properties have been illegally sold. And I said, you know, you need to file a right to information application. He started making all these excuses. And I knew that these original lawyers of mine are very powerful and the system is very corrupt in India. And so, basically, I felt that he'd probably been bribed or threatened into signing. Because they are going to absolutely try and block the evidence from coming out. You know, they will try everything to do that.
So have you actually made trips to India yourself to find out what's going on with these properties?
Well, actually, I think my life is in danger there because a lot of people are, they know that that their fraud is going to be exposed. So, unfortunately, it's very mafia culture there and my life would not be safe. There's lots of authorities involved in this in both India and England. The Director General of the Police also did not do anything despite having my file for almost a year. And the Ministry of External Affairs in India had written to him, and so has Transparency International India, who deal with corruption.
What do you put this down to? You're saying maybe lawyers are being bribed, that sort of thing?
Yes. Well, these lawyers are very powerful, and I've been told that they've committed a fraud. I've only got half the evidence, obviously, you know, with my second barrister, not all of it. So they have, you know, somehow got everybody kind of dealing, you know, wheeling and dealing with them, like the Director General of the Police, who's not done anything, and then the Land Registry in India. They've actually, you see, I've got this occupation certificate, which is in favour of my uncle, but the Land Registry in India keeps saying, actually, it's still in your father's name. And I said, well, if it's in my father's name, why have you given an occupation certificate to my uncle? And they have not actually, you know, responded to that.
Okay, so what's the situation now then?
So the situation is, after this second barrister, I had hired, in total, 15 barristers, one after the other, who all enthusiastically accepted my case and suddenly, suspiciously, declined to act or just stopped communicating. And many other ordinary people with just some legal kind of knowledge also were originally willing to help and then suddenly suspiciously declined.
Well, hang on, isn't that maybe just because you hadn't paid them enough or they wanted more money?
No, I was willing to pay them. I was willing to pay them, nothing to do with the payment. It was all very, very suspicious. And there was also a very strong television channel in India that was willing to take up my story. And suddenly they did a U-turn because the local reporter, I believe, was threatened, where the Director General of the Police is involved with the fraud, and so is the Land Registry.
Okay, so, I mean, it sounds a bit grim for you legally at the moment. What lessons, though, have you learnt from this that you'd like to pass on to others?
Well, I then came to England. Well, I came to England. Of course, I live in England. I went to the Action Fraud here because the lawyers are registered there under Companies House. Action Fraud could take it up, and they did. And the intelligence office found a prima facie case of fraud, and I'd explained to them that I was unable to get all the evidence, only half of it, and they took that into consideration. They then disseminated this to the London Metropolitan Fraud Office. Now, the London Metropolitan Fraud Office, this was just before Christmas last year, they kept ringing me up and said they've got no jurisdiction. And I said, you do, because they're registered under Companies House, the lawyers, even though the fraud might have taken place abroad. And I hired them in England and my money went into the bank in England. And they just kept on, you know, there were three different people I spoke to and they were regurgitating everything, almost as if they rehearsed what to say beforehand. Now, I studied law myself. I used to be a law lecturer and I also obtained legal advice. Under the Fraud Act, they do have jurisdiction, and, you know, that is why the intelligence office had found a prima facie case of fraud. They just did not want to help, and they found every excuse not to. You know, all the precious time they spent in trying to convince me that they had no jurisdiction, you know, they could actually just simply written to the authorities there and, you know, and disclosed the fraud. So they had their own agenda, and I felt they were deliberately misleading me, you know. And then what they did, they actually closed my complaint and blocked my right to appeal. And they put my complaint under a heading called Direction and Control, which actually allows them to block my appeal. The grounds for blocking my appeal was, they said, that the lawyers in question had offered me compensation and I had actually refused. Now, this is completely vacuous. I had been bribed into silence. That is not compensation, and I argued that. The lawyers had said, we will give your money back if you don't say anything, don't talk about it to anybody, and they had not given my search documents. So that is not offering me compensation.
So what lessons have you got for others that are thinking of maybe trying to pursue some sort of legal redress? What have you learned?
Well, what I've learned is that when you have got powerful people involved on the other side, let alone the corruption in any other developing country, there can also be corruption in this country too. This is the lesson that I have learned. And the fact is not to just simply take the people, you know, the police, or no matter how high they are, just to take their word for it, if you smell a rat. I got advice, I rang the IPCC, and I caught them out, basically. You know, and the Professional Standards Department were not actually even contacting me until I said, I'm going to take this to the media, and suddenly they contacted me. But even then, they just closed my complaint, blocking my right of appeal.
Well, I mean, a lot of people have, for example, tried to report large frauds. I mean, we're talking about City of London multi-million pound frauds, etc., to Action Fraud, and not got very far so far. So what's your thoughts about Action Fraud and how effective they are? Because they took over from the Serious Fraud Office a few years ago, and they were supposed to be a whole kind of new, much more dynamic, effective group and organisation.
Well, I feel that Action Fraud were fine. I actually felt they were fine. They had prima facie found a case of fraud in my case. They had done their due diligence. It was actually the London Metropolitan Fraud Office that I found that were being underhanded, in my opinion. I did go to the Serious Fraud Office, and I was very surprised that they didn't actually take it up. They said, this is our criteria. Now, their criteria is that it should be a minimum £1 million worth of, you know, fraud, potentially, and basically there should be a lot of corruption involved. Well, there is.
So how much money do you think you've lost in this case?
Well, I've lost thousands of pounds to lawyers who've not done their job properly, and the property is worth £1 million, you know, which I'm trying to now claim back. And all the authorities seem to just be letting me down, including politicians, which is my next story in this whole thing. That's if you want to go that far.
Yeah, just quickly, yes, tell us how you got on with the politicians.
Well, firstly, I didn't actually contact my MP in the first instance. I contacted another MP in a very Indian area because the lawyers trade very close to his area. And in that constituency, there are plenty of Indian radio stations that are advertising these lawyers. Now, instead of saying to me, actually, you're not my constituent, or saying, actually, I'm going to take it up, he remained quiet. So when I rang his assistant, she said, we've written to the Systems Regulation Authority, but we have received no reply. She also commented that they've received no prior complaints about these lawyers. And I said, are you going to do anything about this? And they said they refused to take any further action. I then went to my own MP who wrote to the Systems Regulation
Authority. So who is your MP?
I'd rather not say at the moment because things are quite sticky and I, you know, things are quite sticky basically and I don't really want to say at the moment. She did actually receive a prompt reply and then the Citizens Regulation also informed me in writing that they had not received a letter from the first MP. So I became rather suspicious and I contacted the political party that the MP belongs to. The secretary of that party did nothing. And I also emphasised that there had been numerous complaints about these lawyers and my experience had been absolutely horrendous. And I could not believe that an MP in a very strong Asian area was not aware of these lawyers' reputation and had actually refused to take any further action. It didn't sound very public-minded to me. So there was also some other people, another councillor in a political party, who was one of these lawyers' referees. He waxed lyrical about them before I took them on. When I started experiencing problems, I rang him up. And instead of being sympathetic, instead of saying, oh, actually, you know, I'm going to look at this, I'm a political man here, and they've also got a company in his constituency, and I don't believe that he, again, does not know their reputation. He actually angrily blocked the mobile phone. He said, don't ever contact me again. And all these people belong to the same party. It is being looked at by Private Eye as we speak. And I've made complaints to these parties and Private Eye is looking at it.
So, look, but, Sangeeta, do you think you're ever going to get your property back, and your money back?
Well, what is required is a simple application of the Right to Information Act, which is needed, and that'll expose all the fraud. Because these people are so powerful, because they threaten everybody, no one is going forward. As I said, 30-odd people have suddenly declined to act when I was going to pay them very handsomely. And, you know, there's about 90 rupees in a pound, so work that out. So this is where we're at, basically, with the whole situation. The Ministry of External Affairs are on it. I've written to Boris Johnson, the Foreign Office. I've written to the Indian High Commission. I'm literally trying everything that I possibly can. And all is what it takes is one simple Right to Information application. I strongly believe that my phone call, it's taken me over a year to realise this, that all my phone calls have been intercepted and my computer's been hacked into. And these powerful people who know how to, you know, get into people's system and find out exactly who I'm communicating with, and, you know, and blocking and threatening.
Okay, well, I hope they're listening to us right now. Anyway, Sangeeta, how do people follow your story, your case?
Well, I'm happy to come back again. And Private Eye, they bring it on. Once Private Eye take it up and it's published, it'll be there and it'll be on the news.
Sounds to me like they've been messing with the wrong woman here.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, that's all for this week. Dialect is Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails and download the podcast the week before broadcast at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guest, Professor Tom Mills. His book, The BBC, Myth of a Public Service. Also, Sangeeta Kanzel, talking about property fraud in India. Also, studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street. That's 0117 909 6897. And email prsc.org.uk. If you want to volunteer, you can do so through the National Volunteering website. For us and many other volunteering opportunities, do-it.org. That was Dialect. And I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now. Thank you.
Put your hands into your